Brigadier Bob Daniel, Reel 1. Could you tell me a little about your life and background before you joined the South Notts Hussars in 1941, Brigadier?
Well, I was brought up in the island of Anglesey, where I spent a delightful early youth. And I was never without a gun. The farmers couldn't have been kinder and nicer to me, and they used to allow me to go wherever I liked to shoot snipe, an occasional pheasant, and an occasional partridge if I ever saw one, but they never hindered me at all. I had an ideal life.
What was your date of birth?
15th of October,
1901. And, for instance, how did the First World War affect you? Because you were too young.
Well, it affected me in this way that we had a team, a Canadian team of horses and men who were timber men, and they cut down 400 of the trees on the estate and helped themselves to the chickens and whatever else they wished. But they were nice men and were as pleasant as circumstances allowed.
Did you follow the war? You know, the events of the war? I mean, you'd be 17 when it ended. But
yes, I followed them to the average extent of a adolescent of my age.
Well, which school did you go to?
I went to, instead of going to the family school of rugby, my mother preferred a modern establishment at which was Gresham's School, Holt, Norfolk. It was the highest category for anybody going into the university. Everyone who, any member of the school who ever went up to the university always got a first class entry, but for me it was hopeless, as there was no army class whatsoever, and the only way in which I ever learned anything, which I had to pass an examination, a public examination, was through reading old papers, which was not very helpful. And I'm often to be surprised that I passed in 44th, but I had no difficulty in passing out of the Royal Military Academy, second, and was then bullied on every side to join the Royal Engineers, which I flatly refused, as I had not joined my family regiment, which was the Irish Royal Irish Fusiliers, the old 87th, because I wished to join a mounted regiment. And when I was at the Royal Military Academy, I insisted on joining the Royal Artillery.
What year did you join the artillery then? When was your commission?
I think it was 1920. Belisha was the war minister, and Belisha was cutting down the army, and he thought one way of cutting them down was to cancel all the young entry into the Royal Military Academy. King George V was furious, and he personally intervened and said, "These young boys are my budding officers of my choice, and you, Mr. Belisha, will have nothing whatsoever to do with them." And we, on joining the army, every single one of the batch, my batch at the Royal Military Academy, went to St. James's Palace for an interview with King George V.
Do you remember anything about it?
Perfectly.
What happened?
We were in our best pose, and we went through the rooms in St. James's Palace, which I got to know very well in the later years. And we were introduced to His Majesty, who was extremely kind to the assembled multitude of young cadets.
Did he say anything to you?
I don't think he said anything to me personally, except that he wished us all well.
Now, what was your first posting then? Okay, sketch through
His
your career.
Battery, at Aldershot North Camp, the Blazers, where every officer had just come back from Ireland, where they'd been serving with the Black and Tans, and they couldn't have been nicer and couldn't have been kinder to a very young, last joined and very young subaltern and extremely ignorant.
And could you sketch in your military career in the peacetime? Because you said
my first duty of colonel sent me to the RAF camp at Farnborough to fetch some hubcaps which had been buffed by the RAF very kindly. And I entered the mess where there were some 40 or 50 very bored RAF officers who had to give up flying, as there was no flying gun at that time. And as I entered the room, a sigh of relief went up that something new was about to take place. I was offered a drink. I had never had a drink before in my life, so I thought I'd better have beer. I may say it took 20 minutes for a pint of beer to arrive. It never struck me that it was laced with every sort of drink you can possibly imagine, but I drank it and I thought it was very good. I sat and was agitated for half an hour till I was offered another drink, which I accepted gleefully, and then fell out of the window onto the flower bed outside. I was quite incapable of walking. I was driven to the camp by the oldest soldier in the battery in a two-wheeled gig, and I found the greatest difficulty in climbing into the gig, because as soon as I got inside, I climbed out the other side, and I finally was driven back under the seat of the gig. And the effect of that interlude, I was extremely ill for a week, and I never again in my life drank beer of any sort or description.
So how long, what number battery was it? You said it was the Blazers.
First battery.
First.
First battery, known as the Blazers.
That's 1st RHA?
No, 1st Field Battery.
Sorry. And how long did they stay in England for?
I took the... I was related to the Daniels who ran a great deal of the export in India, of the export trade. And I'm sorry to say that the biggest trade that they dealt with was the trade to China of the drug, what's it called?
Opium.
Opium. And Sir James Daniel founded the export port of Masulipatnam, just north of Madras, and his activities were well known by the senior and more educated Chinese, who did everything in their power to stop the introduction of the opium. And there were two opium wars. The first war was a skirmish, and the second war was activated from the European side by the International Brigade of Italians, French, and British, and they marched from landing to Pekin, where they entered and the Imperial Palace, which they opened to the troops for loot, as they were unpaid. And the Second Opium War was not repeated. And the effect of opium to the Chinese people was catastrophic. Really, that's all I can tell you about it.
So when what was your next posting?
Oh, my next posting was I took the first, I volunteered at Rindam for that reason, in the spring of the first year that I joined, and left for India within a year. I arrived in India to find that the regiment that I'd been posted to was still in Iraq, where they had been the whole of the First War, outside Kut. The enthusiasm of the officers, which may have been high, was at the very lowest when they returned eventually at the end of the First War. They had no interest in any form of sport of any description. I disliked all of them, and they all disliked me, especially the colonel.
What regiment was this? What was the battery? Do you remember now?
34th.
Battery.
16th Brigade, I think. The girl never knew where I was because I was always hunting and with my native groom who accompanied me everywhere and taught me a vast amount of groundwork of shooting in India, and as there were no restrictions whatsoever, I was continually absent from any form of parade that the other officers took part in.
What sort of hunting was it? What game did you go for mainly?
I was very young. I went for gazelle and nilgai. And as the years went on and I grew older, I could not have been more foolish. I was a loner. I never thought of asking anyone for help or for money, which I had to have in India, because I had not been brought up to do such things. I had an uncle and three of his nephews, three of his sons in India. He was the head of the judicial section. And when he went to the Durbar in 1911, he took his own elephants and his retinue of over 500 men. He was a man of great consequence and knew every Raja and Maharaja in the country, and could have been of immense value. Had I ever had an idea of going to say how do you do to him and asking him to grant me what I wanted to do, which was to shoot a tiger.
That was your ambition then?
My ambition. I had three ambitions when I joined the army. The first one was to get my jacket. In other words, to be chosen for the corps d'élite, the Royal Horse Artillery. That was my first determination. Within a week or two at Aldershot, I realized the immense lure of steeplechasing, as a friend of mine in my battery broke his collarbone and asked me to ride his horses. Firstly, I was there in the Royal Artillery meeting at Sandown, and I should have won the Royal Artillery Gold Cup, but owing to my inexperience and the strength of the enormous horse that I was placed on, I was unable to get it closer than second. But that was my second ambition, was to win the Royal Artillery Gold Cup, and it took me many years. I did win it twice.
What years?
1934 and 1939. And I won the Grand Military Gold Cup in 1933, which was a race entirely beyond my expectations, and I only rode it at the insistence of my very charming trainer, Mr. Eric Steddall.
And your third ambition you mentioned was...
Third ambition was to shoot a tiger on foot. All those three were completed before I was returned to England.
Tell me about the tiger shoot then.
It's not a troublesome thing I have to tell you, but if you want to know it, I will. I within a few weeks of arriving in India, my uncle's eldest son, who I had been best man to in England, he was in the Gurkhas and in charge of a Gurkha establishment at the foothills of the Himalayas. He wrote to my colonel and asked him to let me come up to stay with him during the first hot weather in the country, which he knew I would find very tiring. he had the choice of a very homely, nice woman and a very gay, very attractive sister, which he chose the homely one to marry. I was his best man. She disliked me intensely, and I disliked her intensely. And after the wedding, I didn't see them again until in India, in the foothills of the Himalayas. I found them again, and I found that our mutual dislike was as strong as ever.
Tiger shoot.
Yes, but what was he relation? He was my uncle's son.
Cousin.
My cousin was an extremely nice man. And he realized that the antipathy between his wife and myself was driving me frantic. So he said, would you like to go and see if you could shoot any in India? And I, who always carried a rifle with me, had been shooting deer ever since I joined the ride in India, was delighted and said, of course I would. sent me with a sergeant major who could speak not one word of English, and told him that my life was in his hands, and if I died, he died. We went and stayed in a forest officer's bungalow about 50 miles away, and every morning we went out shooting a mountain deer, small gazelles that inhabited the wooded part of the Himalayas up to 14,000 feet where we were. I was fascinated by the Himalayas, who were always in the background. And on my way up there, I was met at the station where the train stopped, of course, by a warrant officer and some ponies, and was told that we would ride up for 3 days to the cantonment where the Gurkhas were lived. On the way, the custodian of one of the forest bungalows gave me some fresh strawberries to eat. I knew nothing about strawberries in India or any other place. It never struck me that I should have washed them in potassium permanganate. With the result that I was very, very ill. In fact, I thought I was going to die. And I didn't die, but I got gradually, but I must have wasted at least 3 or 4 days in bed. And to my surprise, the custodian of the bungalow brought me in a rice pudding. And it saved my life. I ate it and I recovered, and then I was asked where it came from. The answer was it came from the little old lady who lived about 25 miles away. So I insisted on riding there the next day to thank her. I found a cottage built exactly like a cottage in any English village, thatched with roses round the door, and a charming elderly lady of the age of about 70. And she told me her story. Her father and mother died of cholera when she was 16. The local Maharaja took her under his wing and brought her up. As she grew up, she took charge of the Maharaja's children and taught them English and looked after them. The eldest son, of course, fell in love with her, and he knew he couldn't marry her, but she stayed there till she was about 32. And then his father died, and he became a Maharaja, and it was not seemly that she was still in the palace. So he asked her what she would like to do, whether she would like to go back to England or whether she would like to stay in India. And she said, what I would like to do is to have a small house up in the hills where I can look over the plains and I can know that you are there. And many years later, she told me this when I came to thank her for the rice pudding. After lunch, she asked me, would you not like to go and rest? And I said, yes, indeed. And she said, well, why don't you go and sleep on the hammock between those two fir trees? I said, thank you very much. And I went, got into the hammock, and I happened to look down. And I looked straight down 14,000 feet. I turned as cold as a fish, crawled out of the hammock and crawled back on all fours into the cottage and was only too thankful to be alive. She thought nothing of it, because she spent every day in the hammock, with nothing between her and the plains at the bottom of the Himalayas. Well, I heard rumors from her that a very famous man-eating tiger was in the vicinity. He had come up from the Terai, which is the marshland at the bottom of the Himalayas, which he did frequently. It was 2 or 3 years. And he had killed and eaten several women who were collecting wood or wild fruits on the way up. And he was not very far away. What he told me would make no difference to me, because I never thought I should ever come across such a thing as a man-eating tiger. However, a couple of days later, while I was out shooting, we heard him in a thicket growling. I raced up the hill, took refuge behind a tree, but saw nothing. And he apparently went away. The next night, he killed a girl who had gone out to pick wild fruit, grapes, and figs, and ate half of her. And the head man came to me and asked me if I would help him destroy this well-known man-eater. I said, of course I would. I knew nothing about shooting, nothing about tigers. I couldn't have been more stupid had I just been born. I was taken by the head, the village head man, and several of his confederates, and they made a little hole for me in a very thick rhododendron bush on the side of a path which was soft sand and was immediately above a field where they placed the half-eaten body of the girl. They did this because they thought erroneously that I would be sensible enough, if I saw the tiger, to shoot it. Otherwise, they would never have dreamt of allowing it to be used as a bait for the man-eater. As darkness fell, they left me, they went back to their village, and I had remained sitting in this rhododendron bush at about 8 feet from the ground. Do you want me to hold this? I sat there, and my rifle was fixed to shoot straight where the body of the girl was lying. I couldn't move it either way because the rhododendrons were very thick. After a time, I became aware that there was an animal of some sort immediately below me, as I could smell it and could feel that its presence.